This is Audible.
Listening Library presents The Conference of the Birds, the fifth novel of Miss Peregrine's Peculiar Children by Ransom Riggs, read for you by Kirby Hayborn. Look for the bonus PDF with haunting vintage photographs that accompanies this recording. You who live your lives in cities or among peaceful ways cannot always tell whether your friends are the kind who would go through fire for you. But on the plains, one's friends have an opportunity to prove their mettle. William F. Buffalo Bill Cody. Chapter 1. Deep in the green glowing bowels of a Chinatown seafood market, down a dead-end hallway lined with crab tanks, we crouched in a puddle of dark the light eater had made, watched over by a thousand alien eyes. Leo's men were close, and they were angry. We heard shouts and crashes as they tore apart the market, looking for us.
"Please," I heard an old woman crying, "I didn't see anybody."
We had realized too late that the hallway had no exit, and now we were trapped here, squatting by a drain in a narrow gap between stacks of doomed crustaceans, their tanks piled 10 high in leaning towers that scraped the ceiling. Between the bangs and shouts, beneath our sharp, panicked breathing, was the unceasing rhythm of crab claws tapping glass, an orchestra of broken typewriters burrowing into my skull. At least it would mask the sound of our breathing. Maybe that would be enough if Noor's unnatural dark held, and if the men whose heavy steps were growing louder didn't look too closely at the wriggling void with unsteady edges, an omission in the air, a wrongness unmissable if your eyes came to rest on it. Noor had shaped it by dragging her hand through the air around us, dark spreading in its wake as light collected on her fingertips like luminous cake frosting. She popped it into her mouth, and it glowed through her cheeks and her throat as she swallowed and disappeared. It was Noor they wanted, but they would have happily taken me too, if only to shoot me. By now they had surely found H dead in his apartment, his eyes torn from their sockets by his own hologast. Earlier in the day, H and his holo had broken Noor out of Leo's loop. They hurt some of Leo's guys. That, perhaps, would be forgivable. What was not, Leo Burnham, peculiar leader of the Five Burrows clan, had been humiliated. A feral peculiar he laid claim to had been taken from him in his own house, the power center at the heart of a peculiar empire that spanned much of the eastern United States. If I were discovered helping Noor escape, that, more than anything, would write my death sentence. Leo's men were getting closer, and their shouts were growing louder. Noor tended to her dark, straightening its edges between her finger and thumb when it began to spread out, filling the center when it thinned. I wished I could see Noor's face, read her expression. I wanted to know what she was thinking, how she was holding up. It was hard to imagine someone so new to this world enduring all this without cracking. In the past few days, she had been chased by normals with tranquilizer darts and helicopters, kidnapped by a peculiar hypnotist to be sold at auction, and broken free only to be captured by Leo Burnham's gang. She'd spent days in a cell in Leo's headquarters, then been sleep-dusted in the course of her great escape with H, only to awake in his apartment to find him dead on the floor, the gruesome shock of which had sent a warhead of concentrated light erupting from her like a fireball, one that nearly took off my head. Once she recovered from that shock, I shared with her some of what H told me in his last breaths, that there was one last living hollow slayer, a woman named V, and I was to deliver Noor to her for protection. The only clues to her whereabouts were a torn piece of map from H's wall safe and garbled instructions delivered by H's ghastly ex-hologast, Horatio. But I hadn't yet told Noor why H fought so hard to help her, enlisted me and my friends to the cause, and ultimately died in order to free her from Leo. I hadn't told her about the prophecy. There had hardly been time. We'd been running for our lives ever since I heard Leo's guys in the hallway outside H's apartment. But more than that, I wondered whether, on top of everything else, it would be too much too soon. One of the seven whose coming was foretold, the emancipators of peculiardom, the dawning of a dangerous age. It would sound like the ravings of a lunatic cult member. After all the other demands the peculiar world had made on Noor's credulity, not to mention her sanity, I worried it would send her running for the hills. Any normal person would have run off long ago. Of course, Noor Pradesh was anything but normal. She was peculiar. And more than that, she had some serious iron in her spine. Just then, she leaned her head toward mine and whispered, "So, when we get out of here, what's the plan? Where do we go?" "Out of New York," I said. A slight pause, then, "How?"
"I don't know, a train, a bus?"
I hadn't thought that far ahead.
"Oh," she said with a hint of disappointment. "You can't, like, magic us out of here somehow? With one of your time portal things?"
"They don't really work like that." "Well, I guess some of them do."
I was thinking of connections to the Panopticon, but we'd have to find one.
"What about your friends? Don't you have people?"
Her question made my heart sink.
"They don't even know I'm here."
Then I thought, and even if they did, I felt her shoulders sag.
"Don't worry,"
I said.
"I'll figure something out."
Any other time, my plan would have been simple. Go find my friends. I wished desperately that I could. They would know what to do. They had been my rock ever since I entered this world, and without them I felt unmoored. But H had specifically warned me not to take Noor back to the Imbrans, and anyway, I wasn't sure I had friends anymore, at least not the way I had before. What H had done, and what I was doing right now, was probably destroying any chance of the Imbrans making peace between the clans, and it had almost certainly done irreparable damage to my friend's trust in me. So we were on our own. That made the plan simple but dumb. Run very fast. Think very hard. Get very lucky. And if we didn't run fast enough or get lucky enough, then I might never get a chance to tell Noor about the prophecy. And she would go the rest of her life, however long or short that was, without knowing why she was being hunted. I heard a resounding crash not far away, and then Leo's guys were shouting again. It wouldn't be long now before they reached us.
"There's something I need to tell you about,"
I whispered.
"Can it wait?"
It was the worst time. It was also maybe the only time.
"You need to know, in case we get separated or something else happens."
"Okay,"
she sighed.
"I'm listening."
"This is probably going to sound ridiculous, so before I tell you, just know that I know that. Before he died, H told me about a prophecy."
Somewhere close by, a man was trading shouts with Leo's guys. He in Cantonese, they in English. We heard a loud slap, a cry, a muffled threat. Noor and I both stiffened.
"In the back!"
Leo's man shouted.
"It has to do with you,"
I continued, my lips almost touching her ear. Now she was trembling. The edges of the dark shivered around us, too.
Tell me,
she breathed. Leo's men rounded the corner into the hallway, and we were out of time. The men started along the hall toward us, dragging some poor market worker behind them. The beams of their flashlights played over the walls, refracting off the glass of the crab tanks. I dared not raise my head for fear it might leave the confines of Nor's Dark. I tensed, mentally preparing for a very unbalanced fight. Then, halfway down the hall, they stopped.
Nothing in here but fish tanks, one of the men grunted. Who was with her?
Said a second man.
A boy. Some boy, I don't know.
There was another slap, and the man they were holding groaned in pain.
Let him go, Bowers. He don't know nothing.
The market worker was pushed away roughly. He stumbled to the floor, then picked himself up and ran.
We wasted too much time here, said the first man. The girl's probably long gone by now, along with the creeps who took her.
Think they could have found the entrance to Feng Hua's loop? Asked a third.
Could be, said the first man. I'll take Melnitz and Jacobs to check it out. Bowers, do a full sweep here.
I counted their voices. Now there were four, maybe five of them. The one called Bowers walked right past us, his gun holster hanging at our eye level. I looked up without shifting my head. He was heavy set and wore a dark suit.
Leo's gonna murder us if we don't find her, Bowers muttered.
We're bringing back that dead white, said the second man. That ain't nothing.
I tensed in surprise, my ears pricking. Dead white?
He was dead when we found him, said Bowers.
Leo don't gotta know that,
the first man said, laughing.
What I wouldn't give to have killed him myself, Bowers said.
He reached the dead end to our right and turned back in our direction again. His flashlight spilled over us, then shone into the tank beside my head.
You can go kick his corpse if it'll make you feel better, the third man said.
Nah, I wouldn't mind giving that girl a kick, though, Bowers growled. And more than that,
he started back toward the others.
You see the way she was helping the white?
The first man said, she's just a feral. She don't know any better yet. Just a feral, exactly, said the second man. I still don't understand why we're wasting so much time on her. Just to add one more peculiar to our clan?
Because Leo don't forgive and forget, said the first man.
I felt Nor squirm beside me, then take a deep, steadying breath.
Get me in a room alone with her, growled Bowers. I'll show you how special she is.
He came even with our hiding place, then turned a slow circle, shining his light across the walls and the floor. My eyes came to rest on his holster. His flashlight panned across the tank to our left, then came to rest directly on us. The beams stopped inches from our noses, unable to penetrate Nor's Dark. I held my breath, praying that all of us, even our hair, was hidden. Bowers's expression soured, as if he were trying to make sense of something.
Bowers!
Someone shouted from down the hall. He turned, but kept his flashlight trained on us.
Meet us outside when you're done here. After Fung's, we'll do a three-block perimeter. Pick out a couple fat crabs, said the first man. We'll bring back dinner. Maybe that'll put Leo in a better mood.
The flashlight beam swung back to the tank.
I don't see how people can eat these things, Bowers grumbled to himself. Spiders of the sea.
The others left. We were alone with the flunky. He was 5 feet away, grimacing at the crab tank. He peeled off his jacket and started to roll up his shirt sleeves. All we had to do now was wait, and in a few minutes...
Nora's hand clenched my arm. She was trembling. At first, I thought she was melting down from stress, but then she drew three tiny breaths in quick succession, and I realized she was trying not to sneeze.
Please, I mouthed silently, though I knew she couldn't see me.
Don't.
The man reached gingerly into the tank closest to him. His meaty hand felt around for a crab while he made gentle gagging sounds. Nor went rigid. I could hear her teeth grind as she tried to hold in the sneeze. The man yelped, then yanked his hand out of the tank. He swore and waved his hand wildly in the air while the fat blue crab held fast to one finger. And then Nor stood up.
Hey, she said. Asshole!
The man spun toward us. Before he could get a word out, Nor sneezed. It was a percussive blast. All the light she'd swallowed flew out, splattering the opposite wall and the floor and the man's face in radiant green spray, enveloping him in a ball of glowing light. It wasn't bright enough to hurt him, and not nearly enough to burn, just enough to shock him into brief inaction as his mouth formed a perfect egg-shaped O of astonishment. The small dark void that had enveloped us disappeared in an instant. The man shouted, and for a moment we were frozen, as if under a spell. Me crouched on the floor, Nor standing beside me, her hand over her nose and mouth. The man with one hand held up, a wriggling crab still dangling from it. And then I scrambled to my feet, and the spell was broken. The man moved to block our way, and with his free hand, he reached for his gun. I tackled him before he could use it. He fell back, and I toppled down on him. We grappled for the pistol. I caught an elbow in the forehead, and a sharp pain ricocheted through me. Nor came from behind and thwacked him on the arm with a metal pole she'd found. The man hardly flinched. He got both hands against my chest and shoved me aside. I ran toward Nor to push her away from him. As I reached her, the man squeezed off two shots. The sound was incredible, less a bang than a sonic blast. The first shot I heard caromed off the wall. The second shattered the tank next to him. One moment it was whole, and the next it was falling to pieces, crabs and water and broken glass spilling everywhere, and then the many tanks stacked atop it toppled sideways and forward across the hall. The topmost one exploded as it hit the column of tanks on the opposite wall. The others shattered on top of Bowers. They must have held 100 gallons apiece and weighed a collective ton. Because in the space of 3 seconds, he was both crushed and half-drowned. Meanwhile, a chain reaction of impacts sent nearly all the tanks in the hallway crashing to the floor in a tremendous explosion of noise and glass, freeing their crustacean prisoners in a tidal wave of fetid water that rushed along the hall and knocked us both off our feet. We coughed and choked. The water was disgusting. I looked at Bowers and winced. His face was shredded to strips and glowing with green light. His body was alive with scuttling crabs, but he was very dead otherwise. I turned away quickly and picked through the wreckage toward Nor, who had gotten washed down the hall.
Are you okay?
I asked, helping her up and checking her for cuts. She looked herself over in the dim light.
My limbs are still attached. You?
Same, I said. We'd better go. The other guys will be coming.
Yeah, they probably heard that in New Jersey.
We linked arms to steady each other and moved as fast as we could toward the mouth of the hall, where a neon sign in the shape of a crab buzzed and flickered. We'd hardly made it 10 feet. When we heard heavy footsteps pounding in our direction.
We froze where we stood. Two people, maybe more, were coming for us at a dead run. They had heard us all right.
Let's go,
Nor said, and started pulling me forward.
No,
I stopped, planted my feet. They're too close. They'd be here any second, and the hallway ahead was too long and cluttered with broken tanks. We'd never make it in time.
We've got to hide again.
We have to fight,
she said, gathering what light there was into her hands, but there wasn't much left. That had been my first instinct, too, but I knew it was wrong.
If we fight, they start shooting, and I can't let you get shot. I'll give myself up and tell them you ran somewhere else.
She was shaking her head vehemently.
No way in hell.
Even in the dark, I could see her eyes flashing. She let the tiny ball of light she'd raked up dissipate and retrieved two long shards of glass from the floor.
We fight together or not at all?
I let out a frustrated sigh.
Then we fight.
We crouched down, shards of glass held out like knives. The footsteps were loud, and so close we could hear the approaching runners' heavy breaths. And then they were here. A figure appeared at the end of the hall, silhouetted against neon. Someone stocky, broad-shouldered, and familiar, though I couldn't immediately place them.
Mr. Jacob,
a voice I recognized said,
is that you?
A shimmer of light fell across her face, her strong, square jaw, her kind eyes. I thought, for a moment, that I must be dreaming.
Bronwyn?
I said, almost shouted.
It is you,
she cried, her face breaking into a wide grin. She ran toward me, bounding around drifts of broken glass, and I dropped the shard of glass just before Bronwyn wrapped me in a big, breath-stealing hug.
Is that Miss Noor?
She said over my shoulder.
Hi,
Noor said, sounding a bit stunned.
Then you succeeded,
Bronwyn said.
I'm so happy.
What are you doing here?
I managed to squeak.
We might ask the same of you,
said another familiar voice, and as Bronwyn let me go, I saw Hugh coming toward us.
Blimey, what happened in here?
First Bronwyn, now Hugh. My head was spinning. Bronwyn set me down.
Never mind that. He's all right, Hugh. And here's Miss Noor.
Hi, Noor said again. Then quickly, so there's like four guys with guns coming for us right now.
I coshed two on the head,
said Bronwyn, holding up a pair of fingers.
I chased off another with my bees, said Hugh.
More will be coming, I said.
Bronwyn picked up a heavy-looking metal bar from the floor.
Then let's not dally, shall we?
The subterranean seafood market was a baffling maze, but we navigated its wriggling nooks and crannies as best we could, each twosome struggling to remember just how we'd gotten down here and which of the Chinese language signs around us meant exit. The place was both cramped and sprawling, packed tight with crates and tables, divided by hanging tarps, nests of dangerous-looking electric wires, and bare bulbs that swung overhead. It had been crowded a short time ago, but Leo's guys had pretty well cleared it out.
Try and keep up,
Bronwyn called over her shoulder. We slid after her under a table squirming with live octopi, then chased her down an aisle of fish laid out in boxes of steaming dry ice. Turning left at a junction with another aisle, we saw two of Leo's men. One was splayed on the ground, and the other was crouching next to him, attempting to revive him with little slaps on the face. Bronwyn didn't slow her pace at all, and the man looked up in surprise just as she delivered a running kick to his head and sent him sprawling onto the ground beside the other one.
Very sorry,
she called behind her, and in reply there came a pair of shouts from far across the market. Two more of Leo's guys had spotted us and were now charging in our direction. We took a sharp turn and ran up a narrow stairway, then slammed through a door and burst out into daylight, briefly blinded after having spent so long in the gloom. Suddenly, we were on a busy sidewalk at rush hour in the present day. Cars and pedestrians and street vendors were everywhere, zipping around us in a dizzying whirl. There's an art to fleeing casually. It's not easy running from something that might kill you while not attracting stares. Seeming to be engaged in something no more dramatic than an afternoon jog, especially when two of you are soaked head to toe, two of you are dressed in 19th century clothes, and all of you keep shooting nervous glances down every alley and back over your shoulders. Apparently, we hadn't got the hang of it, because we were getting even more stares than two costumed and two wet teenagers should have warranted, especially in New York, where strange people populated most sidewalks. We jaywalked, we ignored red lights and don't walk signs, edging into the street until there was a stall in traffic, or sometimes just going for it in a mad dash and letting the cars honk and swerve, because getting run over was better than being dragged back to Leo's loop. His goons had been on us like a bad cold, tailing us through the grit of Chinatown and up the streets of a touristy Italian neighborhood, then nearly catching up to us when we got stuck on the median strip of busy Houston Street. They were easy to spot in their old suits. Finally, just when I was beginning to wonder how much longer I could run, Noor poured on more speed to catch up with Bronwyn and pulled her around a corner. Hugh and I followed them, and a short time later, Noor hauled Bronwyn to the side again, this time through a door into a seemingly random store. It was a cramped little bodega that sold beer and dry goods. As the owner shouted something at us, we all saw two of Leo's guys dash past the front door without stopping. Then Noor pushed us down a narrow aisle, through a door into a stockroom, past a surprised employee on a smoke break, and out through a swinging metal door into an alley lined with dumpsters. It seemed we had shaken them off, for a moment anyway, and we allowed ourselves to stop for a minute and catch our breath. Bronwyn had hardly broken a sweat, but Noor, Hugh, and I were gasping. "That was quick thinking," Bronwyn said, impressed. "Yeah," Hugh said. "Nicely done." "Thanks," said Noor. "Not my first rodeo."
"We should be safe here for a minute," Hugh said between breaths. "Let's give them some time to think we're long gone, then move."
"I should probably ask where you're taking us," I said. "I'd certainly love to know," Noor said, one eyebrow rising.
"Back to the acre," said Hugh. "Closest loop entrance ain't pleasant, but it ain't far."
I couldn't stop looking at my friends. Part of me had worried I might never lay eyes on them again, or that if I did, they would act like strangers. And then Hugh drew back his fist and punched me in the arm.
"Ow! What was that for? Why didn't you tell us you were doing some daft rescue mission?"
Noor was gaping at us.
"I tried," I said.
"Not very hard, you didn't," said Bronwyn.
"Well, I dropped some awfully big hints," I said defensively, "but it was pretty clear no one wanted to help me." Hugh looked ready to punch me again.
"Maybe not, but we would have."
"We never would have let you do something like this alone," Bronwyn said, sounding angry at me for the first time. "We were worried sick when we found you gone."
She turned to Noor and shook her head.
"He was in a sick bed just yesterday, mad boy. Thought somebody'd kidnapped him in the night."
"To be honest, I wasn't really sure you'd care that I was gone," I said.
"Jacob!"
Bronwyn's eyes went wide.
"After all we've been through,
That's just hurtful.
Told you he was a sensitive, Sally.
Hugh shook his head.
Give your old mate some credit, man. My God.
Sorry,
I said meekly.
I mean, really?
Nor leaned toward me and whispered,
No friends, huh?
I don't know what to say. My heart was suddenly so full it seemed to crowd out the words from my brain. I'm really glad to see you guys.
And we you, said Bronwyn.
She hugged me again, and this time Hugh did too.
And then a gunshot rang out from one end of the alley, and we all startled, then broke apart to see two men in suits booking it toward us. So much for shaking them off.
Follow me, Noor said. We can lose them in the subway.
I shot down the subway steps three at a time. Hugh slid on the metal banister. In the crowded vestibule, we shoved through knots of rush hour commuters. Noor shouted, Like this! Behind her, and then jumped a turnstile. We all followed suit. We came to a train platform and ran along it. I looked back and saw Leo's guys, distant but still chasing us. Noor stopped, planted a hand on the floor, jumped down onto the subway tracks, and shouted for us to follow. She yelled something about a third rail, too, though her voice got lost in the noise of a sudden station announcement. We had no choice but to go after her.
You're going to get yourselves killed,
somebody yelled at us, and I was inclined to agree. But right now, this seemed preferable to the alternative. We were dashing across four sets of tracks, stumbling over hidden pits and dark rails, when it occurred to me that Noor had obviously done this before, that she knew the city like the back of her hand, and that someone so hard to catch must have had lots of experience running away. And I wondered why and from what, and I very much hoped, as I noticed a train coming, that I'd get a chance to ask her. The train was uncomfortably close as Hugh and I crossed the last track, the wind and noise it pushed strengthening by the second, and then Bronwyn and Noor hauled us up onto the opposite platform just before it thundered past, brakes squealing like some creature from hell. Moments later, the train disgorged its passengers, and suddenly there seemed to be 1,000 people on the platform, but finally we were able to push our way on board. We crouched down on the floor so we couldn't be seen. The car was nearly empty, and then the doors slid shut.
Gee, Bronwyn said, looking suddenly worried. I hope this train's going in the right direction.
Noor asked where we were supposed to be heading, and Bronwyn told her. Noor raised her eyebrows.
Weird luck, she said. That's just a stop away.
It was amazing. Of the four of us, she knew by far the least about what was happening, but her certainty and calm had already become a guiding force. An announcement blared, and the train took off from the station.
How did you find me? I said to Bronwyn and Hugh.
Emma realized what you were probably up to, after all your talk about her.
Hugh nodded to Noor and said,
Nice to properly meet you, by the way. I'm Hugh.
He reached over and shook Noor's hand.
It was a fairly simple matter to find you after that,
Bronwyn said.
Oh, and we had some help from a dog. Remember Addison?
I nodded.
Sharon's Panlupticon toadies tracked you to New York, and Addison's nose was able to track you to that market, said Hugh. But that's as far as he would go.
Bless that little dog, I thought. I was losing count of how many times he'd risked his life for us.
You were easy to find from there, said Bronwyn. We followed the shouting.
Did Miss Peregrine send you? I said.
No, said Hugh. She doesn't know about this.
She probably does by now, said Bronwyn. She's awfully good at knowing things.
We thought more than two of us leaving might attract too much attention.
We all drew straws, said Bronwyn. Hugh and me won.
She glanced at Hugh.
Think Miss P will be mad at us for coming?
Hugh nodded vigorously.
Steaming, but proud too, assuming we can get him back home in one piece.
Home? Nora said. Where's that?
A loop in late 1800s London called Devil's Acre, Hugh said. Closest thing we got to a home, anyhow.
Nora's eyebrows furrowed.
Sounds delightful.
It's rough around the edges, but it has a certain charm. It's better than living out of a suitcase, at any rate.
Nora looked a bit doubtful.
And it's a place for people like you?
For people like us, I said. She didn't react, or tried not to, but I saw a flicker of something behind her eyes. An idea, perhaps, that was starting to register. Us.
You'll be safe there, said Bronwyn. No men with guns chasing you, no helicopters.
I was about to agree, but then I remembered H's warning about the Imbrins, and the things Miss Peregrine had said to me in the last conversation we'd had about certain sacrifices being necessary for the greater good. One of those sacrifices being Nor herself.
What about all the things H told us we need to do?
Nor said to me. She had lowered her voice a bit, unsure of whether Bronwyn and Hugh knew, or should know, about this.
Oh, what things? Hugh asked.
I said, before he died, H gave me some information about Nor and the people who've been chasing her, and he said we needed to find a woman named V, that there were important things about this that only she knew.
V? Isn't that the Hollow Slayer your grandfather trained?
Asked Bronwyn. Bronwyn had been at the Diviner's Loop when V's name had first come up. Of course, she remembered.
The same, I said. And H, well, his hologast, showed us a map and gave us some instructions on how to find her.
His hologast? Gasped Bronwyn.
I pulled the paper map fragment out of my pocket and showed them. He wasn't a hologast anymore. He was turning into something else.
You mean a white? Said Hugh. That's the only thing hollows turn into.
Nora gave me a confused look.
You said the whites are our enemies.
They are, I said. But H was friends with this particular hollow.
This is getting more and more surreal, Nora said.
I know, and that's why I think we should go with them to Devil's Acre, I said. We need help, and all the peculiars I know and trust are there. Whether or not they would ever trust me again, or would be willing to help after what I'd put them through, was another matter. But I had to try. I needed my friends. H's warning be damned. If Miss Peregrine was really capable of sending the girl we had just helped rescue back into the hands of her captors for some political reason, or any reason, then she wasn't the Miss Peregrine I thought I knew. And if I couldn't keep Nor from harm in a loop full of friends, how was I supposed to help her navigate the wilderness of peculiar America?
Millard's a cartography expert, said Bronwyn.
And Horace is a prophet, I added, part-time at least.
Yeah, Nor said, her eyes sliding to me. You never finished telling me about that.
The prophecy. I wanted to tell her in private, not in front of other people. It seemed we were no longer in immediate danger.
It can wait, I said.
Hugh and Bronwyn both gave me curious looks.
If you say so,
Nor said, but she was starting to sound impatient. The train began to stop. We were at the next station. We ran up out of the subway and back onto daylit streets. Nora took a moment to help Bronwyn get oriented.
It's not far now, Bronwyn promised, guiding us diagonally through four lanes of traffic as horns blared. We cut through a basketball court with a game in progress, through a sad green space overwhelmed by a looming pair of old condo towers. With each block, the neighborhood was getting worse, rusty, and chewed up, until finally we were in the shadow of a huge brick building covered in scaffolding and ringed by chain-link fences skinned with green tarps. Bronwyn stopped and pulled a tarp back, revealing a hole in the fence. Nora and I traded a quick, hesitant glance. Bronwyn and Hugh waved at us to follow and then disappeared through the hole. Hugh popped his head back out.
You two coming?
Nor squeezed her eyes shut for a second, no doubt fighting some version of what the hell am I doing in her head, then climbed through. Though she might not have believed me, I often fought that same battle. A voice inside me had been shouting, "What the hell are you doing?" more or less daily since I'd gone to Wales on a hunch to chase down ghosts from old photos. I'd gotten better at tuning it out, and it had gotten a lot quieter, but it was still there. On the other side of the fence was a different world, or a much sadder and grimmer one, at any rate. Stepping through was like peeling back a corpse's shroud. The building had been built and finished long ago, then left to ruin. I stood in the wild grass and allowed myself one long breath to take it in. 10 stories tall and wide as a city block, leaded windows all broken, bricks scabbed and veined with dead vines. Grand steps led up to a doorway framed in fancy wrought iron curlicues. Above it, carved into a heavy marble slab, were the words, "Psychiatric Hospital."
How fitting, Nora said under her breath. I must be losing my mind.
You're not. I'd been waiting for this, for everything to start sinking in. I know it feels like you are, but you're not. I promise. Bronwyn and Hugh were 20 feet ahead, waving with increasing urgency for us to follow. Nora wasn't looking at me.
I was drugged. I ate bad mushrooms. I'm in a coma. This is all a dream.
She rubbed her hands on her face.
Anything makes more sense than...
I said, I can't prove you're not dreaming, but I do know what you're going through. Bronwyn was running back toward us now and mouthing, "Come on, come on, come on." The fence rattled behind us, and someone swore. Then another voice said, "I know there's a way through here somewhere," and someone else grunted in reply. It was a couple of Leo's guys. They had tracked us all this way. If Nor had been contemplating some other course of action, that rattling fence banished it from her mind. We raced through the high grass with Bronwyn and Hugh, up the steps past signs that blurred in my vision but said things like, "Condemned property" and "No trespassing," to an entrance that had been boarded over and broken open again. The splintered wood and bent nails gnawed us like teeth as we contorted ourselves into the breach, once more to be entombed in a place we might never leave. The building was so dark and packed with trash that we couldn't quite run, not without impaling ourselves on some sharp obstacle or tripping into a hole in the floor, so instead we scurried sideways like crabs, taking long, kicking steps and sweeping our arms in front of us, following Hugh and Bronwyn. They were familiar with this place. We could hear Leo's guys in the yard coming through the fence, pounding up the steps. Bronwyn had blocked the hole through which we'd entered by shoving an old fridge in front of it. It seemed to have been left close by for just that purpose, but we knew that wouldn't slow Leo's guys for long. We stumbled into a large room lit by filthy, half-boarded windows where we could finally see. We dodged moldering wheelchairs and nightmarish hulks of rusting medical equipment our feet splashing through a shallow sea of toxic-looking water that stretched from wall to wall. Nora was humming quietly to herself. I glanced at her, and she stopped. "Nervous habit," she said. I hopscotched around a patch of caved-in floor, then held out my hand to help her across. "What's there to be nervous about?" I said, managing a mirthless grin. She took my hand and leapt. She wasn't laughing. "Please tell me there's a back way out of here."
"Better than that," said Hugh over his shoulder. "It's a panopticon door."
Before Nora could reply, there came a sound so eerie and out of place, it sent shivers through me. A sour, dissonant chord of unmusical music. Rounding a stack of sodden yellow mattresses, we saw where it had come from. A gutted piano. It was an upright model that had been knocked onto its back and lay blocking the room's only exit to a hallway lined with doors. The piano's intestines had been ripped out and nailed to points all around the hallway entrance, the heavy strings rising like a forest of metal hair standing on end. To get out of this room, we would have to climb over the piano and squeeze through the strings. Someone had done it already. That must have been the awful chord we'd heard, which meant that someone had just left this room, or was in it with us now. And then, out from behind a tipped-over baby incubator not far away, a figure rose to standing.
"Ah, it's you."
His face was covered by a mat of hair so thick it could only be called fur, and he gave us a cockeyed grin. It was Dogface.
"Back so soon?" he said to Bronwyn and Hugh. "Yes, but we can't stay," said Bronwyn.
"We need to get out now," said Hugh.
Dogface leaned against the piano.
"Exit fee is 200.
"You said the fee was round trip," Hugh said angrily.
"You must have misheard me. You did seem to be in an awful hurry when I was explaining our pricing."
We heard a distant shout, then the scrape of metal against stone. They were starting to move the refrigerator. Dogface tipped his head toward the sound.
"What's that? You haven't gotten yourselves into trouble, have you?"
"Yeah," I said irritably. "There's someone chasing us."
"Oh, no,"
he said, clicking his tongue at me.
"That's going to cost you a bit extra. We'll have to deceive them, cover for you. And those are Leo Burnham's flunkies. They sound angry."
"Fine, whatever it costs," said Bronwyn. We were dying to just knock him out of the way, but we knew he could cause us endless trouble if he wanted to.
500,
said Dogface. Another scraping sound, this one longer than the last. They were making progress.
"I only have 400, said Hugh, digging in his pocket.
"Too bad."
Dogface turned to go.
"We'll pay you tomorrow," said Bronwyn.
Dogface turned back.
"Tomorrow, it'll be 700.
There was a loud, splintering crash. They'd broken through.
"Okay, fine,"
Hugh said, an agitated bee escaping his lips.
"And don't be late with it. I'd hate to have to show them your little secret door."
They paid him all they had. Dogface counted it with excruciating exactness, then stuffed the bills into his pocket. He climbed onto the piano, pulled a lever inside it, then slipped silently through the muted strings. We followed, and when we'd reached the other side, he pushed the lever back into place. The piano, I realized, was an alarm. Dogface showed us the way. We rushed after him down a long hall. Now that he'd extorted us, he started picking up the pace, but the hallway seemed to stretch on forever. Along the way, a clutch of peculiars filed out from one of the doorways and began to follow us. They were unusual looking, even by peculiar standards, and when Nora saw them, she drew a sharp breath. A woman who was either legless or whose legs were invisible wafted after us on a cushion of air, the bottom of her long coat fluttering in the vacancy.
"Ah, sweetheart, we're not gonna hurt you," she said, her voice soft and melodious. "We'll be friends."
"Don't know about friends," snorted a girl who was at least half warthog, two tusks and a snout protruding from her face. "But if you pay good, we won't be enemies." Then came another legless lady, this one apparently unable to float, because she moved by taking great leaps forward on her hands. Then, with the litheness of a cat, she jumped into the burly warthog girl's waiting arms. I could see her properly there. She lacked not only legs, but hips, waist, and half a torso. Her body and the black satin blouse she wore were cropped in a neat line near her belly button.
"Hattie the Halfsea," she said, giving us a little salute. "Which one of you is the famous Feral?"
"Don't call her that,"
snapped a teenage boy with a huge pulsating boil on his neck.
"It's derogatory."
"Fine. Uncontacted." "She's not that either anymore," said Dogface. "She's had to learn fast."
The warthog girl let out a snorting laugh.
"Not fast enough from the looks of her."
Nora's jaw was locked tight, as if through sheer force of will she was forcing herself forward.
"These curious souls are the untouchables," Dogface said,
turning to walk backward for a moment like a tour guide.
"The ones no other clan wanted."
"Too peculiar to ever pass as normal," said Hattie.
"The most appalling, most unspeakable, most disgusting peculiars anywhere,"
the boy with the boil said proudly.
"I don't think you're disgusting," said Bronwyn.
"Take it back,"
said Warthog Girl, scowling. Dogface twirled like a dancer and slid through an open door.
"And this is our sanctum sanctorum. Well, the front door, anyhow."
We followed him into the room, and then Nora and I stopped cold. In the middle of the floor was an operating table, and honeycombed into the back wall were a dozen small freezer doors. This room was not only a dead end, it was the hospital's morgue.
"It's okay," Bronwyn said to Nora, gentle but urgent. "It won't kill us."
"Oh, hell no," Nora said, backing away. "There's no way I'm hiding in one of those things."
"Not hiding," Hugh said. "Traveling."
"She don't like it," said the warthog girl. "She's scared."
The untouchables all tittered in the doorway behind us. Nora was already out of the room, crossing to another open door across the hall, the last alternative before going back the way we'd come. Bronwyn and Hugh started after her, but I blocked them.
"Let me talk to her," I said.
Climbing into a morgue freezer would have been a hard sell for anyone, peculiar or otherwise, but especially for someone so new to this world. I didn't particularly relish the idea myself. I ran across the hall to join Nora in the other room. There was a bare metal cot lit by a beam of sunlight from a barred window. The corners were stacked up with discarded personal items that had belonged, presumably, to people who'd lived and died in the institution. Suitcases, shoes. Nora was agitated, turning from side to side.
"I could have sworn I saw a door here. When we were running by before..."
"There's no other way out," I said. Then I saw it, and my stomach sank.
"You mean this?"
She turned to look, and when she registered what it was, I thought she might cry. It was part of a mural on the wall, a trompe-l'oeil, a door made of paint. And then we heard the piano clang once, twice, three times. Leo's men had climbed through.
"We have a choice," I said. "We can either..."
She wasn't listening.
She was focused on the barred window and the sun beaming through it. I started again. We can either stay here and wait for them to definitely find us. She swept the air with both hands, but succeeded only in scraping finger trails of darkness through it, which quickly filled in again with light. I'd seen this sort of thing before. Some peculiar abilities function like muscles, and they can be strained, exhausted. Others get shy when the pressure's on. She turned to face me. Or I can trust you. Yes, I said, willing her toward me with every fiber of myself. Me and a bunch of weirdos. Leo's men were thundering down the outer hallway, searching rooms, rattling locked doors. This is absurd. She shook her head, then met my eyes, and something in her steadied. I shouldn't trust you, but I do. She'd accepted so much absurdity already. What was a little more in the balance when it might save us? Bronwyn and Hugh were waiting at the door, looking panicked.
Ready? Hugh said.
Better be, said Dogface, leaning in. By the way, if we have to cash one of them for you, that's 1,000.
Or Miss Poubelle can memory wipe them for 2, said the boy with a pulsating boil.
The men spotted us darting across the hall. I didn't look back, but I could hear their shouts and footfalls. The untouchables had disappeared. They clearly didn't want to tangle with Leo's men or make enemies of them if they didn't have to. In the morgue, one of the lower body freezers was now unlatched and hanging open. Hugh was standing beside it, and when he saw us coming, he called to us, waved us on, and dove in. We ran to the open freezer and squinted into the blackness inside. It wasn't just a cabinet for a corpse. It was a narrow tunnel that seemed to go on forever. Hugh's voice echoed from somewhere deep within, receding quickly.
Whoa!
I waited for Noor to go first. This is stupid. I'm so stupid. This is so stupid, she was chanting. But then she took a deep breath, steeled herself, and climbed in head first. She slid in part way, but then got a little stuck, so I grabbed her feet and pushed, and in a moment the little compartment in the morgue wall swallowed her up. Bronwyn went next, at my insistence, and then it was my turn. It was harder to make myself climb in than it should have been, considering I was the one who had convinced Noor to do it. It was such an unnatural action, shoving oneself into a morgue tray, that it took a few seconds of special effort for my rational mind, which knew that horrible, dark, tunnely places made excellent loop entrances, to overcome my natural instincts, which were saying, "No, no, no, you'll be eaten by zombies, no!" The sound of angry men bursting through the door behind me helped a great deal, though, and before they got to me, I was in, wriggling deeper and deeper as fast as I could. A hand grabbed my foot. I managed to kick it off. I heard a struggle behind me, and there was a dull thud, and one of the men cried out. I glanced back to see one of Leo's guys falling to the floor, the warthog girl behind him with a hunk of wood held in her hand. I could hear Noor ahead of me, somewhere, grunting as she army crawled forward on her elbows, farther and farther into the black. I pushed forward, then began to slide without effort. The tunnel was greased with something, and it angled downward slightly. After a few feet, forward momentum began to take me. It felt something like being born, I imagined, only faster and much longer. Then I heard Noor scream. I felt myself being actively pulled through by something, not a hand, but a bodiless force that gripped every part of me, like gravity. I felt that quickening in my blood and that lurch in my stomach that I knew so well.
we were crossing over.
Chapter 2. We tumbled out of a small closet onto the long red-carpeted hallway of Bentham's Panlupticon. Bronwyn was collecting herself when Nora and I arrived, and Hugh was already waiting, looking slightly impatient.
"I was beginning to wonder if you decided not to join us," he said as Bronwyn pulled Nora and I up effortlessly.
"Do you think they'll come after us?" I said, glancing nervously at the door.
"No chance," Bronwyn said. "The untouchables like to get paid."
I turned to Nor.
"How are you?"
I said, quiet and close.
"I'm fine," she said quickly, seeming embarrassed. "Really sorry about my little freakout back there."
She was talking to the three of us and looking around at the plush hallway.
"This place is definitely better than the one we just left."
Hugh started to say we should be going, but Nor interrupted him.
"One more thing I need to say before we go anywhere or meet anyone else."
She looked at us.
"Thank you all for helping me. I'm grateful."
"You're welcome,"
Hugh said, maybe a bit too breezily. She frowned.
"I'm serious." "We are too," said Bronwyn.
"You can thank us when we get back to the house," said Hugh. "Come on, or Sharon's toadies will notice us and start asking questions I imagine we'd rather not answer."
"Right enough," Bronwyn said.
We walked quickly down the hall in a tight cluster. This section of the Panlupticon was relatively deserted, but after rounding a few corners, it began to get crowded. Peculiars dressed in outfits spanning every era and style were coming and going from loop doors. A sand drift was collecting outside one door, and a howling wind was spitting rain from another, held open a crack by a brick stuck in the jam. People were lined up against the walls to have their travel documents checked and stamped by bureaucrats at small standing desks, and the echo of voices and footsteps and papers being shuffled made the place sound like a train station at evening rush hour. Nor's eyes were wide and roving, and I could hear Bronwyn, a hand on her back, attempting to explain our surroundings in a low voice.
"Every one of these doors leads to a different loop. It's called the Panlupticon, and it was invented by Miss Peregrine's extremely brilliant brother, Bentham, then taken over by her extremely evil other brother and our worst enemy, Call."
"It's actually proved quite useful," Hugh cut in. "This loop we're in, Devil's Acre, used to be a prison for miscreant peculiars, then became a lawless place, and our enemies, the Whites, made their headquarters here, until Jacob helped us smash them and killed their leader," Bronwyn said proudly.
At the mention of Call, goosebumps had spontaneously broken out on my arms. "He's not exactly dead," I interjected.
"Fine," said Hugh. "He's trapped in a collapsed loop he can never ever get out of, which is basically the same thing.
And now the Whites are all dead or locked up in jail," said Bronwyn, "and because they destroyed or seriously damaged many of our loops, a lot of peculiars had nowhere else to go and were forced to move in here."
"Temporarily, we hope," Hugh said. "The Imbrins are trying to rebuild the loops we lost now."
Nor was starting to look overwhelmed, so I said, "Maybe we should save the history lecture for later." We were passing a long row of windows, and Nor stared out as we walked. It was Devil's Acre on a supersaturated yellow afternoon, the kind only intense air pollution can create. The acre's crumbling buildings, snaking green-black fever ditch, smoking streets' eternal haze, and beyond it, old London, a confusion of spires and gray buildings receding into a cauldron of industrial-age soot.
"My God,"
Nor said, voice just above a whisper. I was walking next to her. "This is London. late 19th century. And you're feeling that thing again, aren't you?
The can't be reals, she said, slowing long enough to reach through an open window and wipe one finger along the ledge.
As we sped up to keep pace with the others, she held it up. Her finger had turned black with soot.
But it is real, she marveled.
Yes, it is. She angled herself toward me.
Do you ever get used to it?
A little more every day. I thought about it, tried to remember how hard it had been, even recently, to accept this world as real. I still have moments where I look around and my head swims, like I'm in the grip of some
nightmare.
I was going to say dream. She nodded, a small assent, and I felt a shared recognition flicker between us, of a darkness mutually understood, and of a thin golden thread of wonder and hope that ran through the fabric of this new world.
There is more, it said.
There is more to the universe than you ever imagined. Then, in the corner of my vision, another kind of darkness appeared, and I felt a chill come over my whole body.
So you're alive,
a slithering whisper in my ear.
I must say I'm pleased.
I turned to see a wall of black robes. It was Sharon, towering behind us. Nor pressed her back against the window, but her face betrayed no fear. Hugh and Bronwyn saw what was happening and slunk over to an informational stand about loop costuming, trying not to be noticed.
Are you going to introduce me to the young lady?
Sharon said. Sharon, this is...
I'm Noor, said Noor, thrusting out her hand. And you are?
Just a humble boatman. How very nice to meet you.
A gleaming grin appeared within the black tunnel of his hood, and his long white fingers wrapped around Noor's soft brown ones. I saw her try to suppress a shudder. He retracted his hand and turned to me.
You missed our meeting. I was very disappointed.
I got busy, I said. Can we talk about this later?
Of course,
he said with exaggerated subservience.
Please, don't let me keep you.
We slipped away from him. Bronwyn and Hugh were waiting by the stairwell.
What did he want?
Asked Hugh.
I have no idea, I lied, and we hurried down the stairs.
The streets of Devil's Acre were packed with peculiars, and on that particular afternoon, the strange and sometimes alarming contrasts that defined the place were on full display. We passed an Imbrin teaching a group of young peculiars how to repair a ruined building using their peculiar talents. There was a red-headed boy levitating a stack of lumber with his mind, and two girls were reducing a pile of jagged rubble to gravel very slowly by grinding down the boulders with their teeth. We passed Sharon's cousins, too. The singing, hammer-swinging gallows riggers were leading a chain gang of miserable white prisoners in leg shackles, followed by an Imbrin and a contingent, 10 strong, of peculiars assigned to guard duty. Noor turned to watch as they passed, singing at full volume.
The night before the thief was stretched, the hangman came around. I've come, he said, before you're dead, a warning.